You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 28th, 2016. I'm Michael Brooks, pinch-hitting for Sam Steeter, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, journalist and legal scholar Rafia Zakaria. She's joining us to talk about the really brutal and horrific terror attacks that occurred in Lahore, Pakistan over this past weekend, the bigger security picture in Pakistan, and decolonizing education. That's her recent piece. Bernie Sanders had a great weekend. Big wins in Washington State. In Hawaii. He also had a sort of quasi-religious moment, which we'll play for you. In Georgia, that governor has just vetoed an anti-LGBT ordinance. An impressive response to pressure from the NBA, the NFL, and other big businesses opposed to anti-LGBT bigotry in the 21st century. We'll touch on that. While in North Carolina, that governor actually went ahead and signed a bill promoting bigotry. Touch on that as well. What's happening in Brazil looks like a judicial coup. And Dilma and Lula are not blameless. That's a really questionable situation. We'll get to that. Speaking of questionable situations, John Kerry says that this presidential election is undermining us internationally. And of course, he's right. And the Donald Trump Ted Cruz contest continues to disgust and amaze. And it's also reopened a classical question. Is power the ultimate aphrodisiac? Because if power is working for Ted Cruz, it could quite literally work for anybody. As those rumors continue to circulate, they've created some amazing new pieces of sound. Alex Jones, an virulently homophobic pastor and Obama original, like OG Obama hater, Pastor David James Madding, they want to know whether or not President Obama's a vampire. So there's a lot to get to on today's show. Really quickly, I just want to let everybody know we're up to its 136 rankings and 81 reviews for Two Dope Boys. We have a new show dropping tomorrow. I really appreciate everybody's feedback and support. Matt, will you let everybody know how they can subscribe to Two Dope Boys easily?
Well, you can either go to subscribe to, that's the number, at db.com. That takes you right to the iTunes page. Or you can go to twodopeboyspod.com, which is our website, and there's links there. And
join
show
us.
Notes and stuff, too.
Show
it's
notes.
Great.
Look, Matt did a tremendous job. It's true. And I don't have an elegant transition for this. I can just tell you that we all know that sleep is incredibly important. I'm reminded of the value of sleep every day when I see Sam Steeter's exhausted, drained, and bone, just agonized face. as his children and his obligations just endlessly keep him up at night. I've actually even occasionally gotten, I think, some type of bizarre mirror neuron, like insomnia from just being around Sam so much. So we all know the importance of sleep. And that's why today's sponsor, Casper Mattresses, who were obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at a shockingly low price. They can help you get the sleep you need. And you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority and using the code word majority. Listen, you spend about a third of your life sleeping, which is really kind of amazing. You spend literally a third of your life laying in a darkened room, incapacitated, and unaware of your surroundings. We all know that with Sam, it's about a fifth, and with me, because of my exposure to Sam, it's about a fourth. But whether it's a fifth or a fourth or a third, you're spending a lot of the time that you're here on planet Earth sleeping, and you need to do it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies for better night's sleep and brighter days, latex foam and memory foam, so you get just the right sink, just the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. They've got a risk-free trial and return policy. They'll deliver it straight to you, and you can try it for 100 days. And if you're not happy, they'll pick it right back up. I find that hard to believe that you wouldn't be happy. I mean, it's insane to just go to a mattress store, jump on a mattress for a few minutes, and make such a major life decision. It's crazy. With Casper, you get 100 days to literally sleep on it. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size mattress. Compare that to industry averages, and that's an outstanding price. It really is. So get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/majority using the code word majority. That's casper.com/majority using the code word majority. And Matt, throw a link up to that on our website on the Majority Report homepage. We will be right back with Rafia Zakaria.
Yo, remember back on the Bully when cats used to harmonize like yo. My men and my women, don't forget about the dean. This is not the most the king, yo. It's about a thing, yeah.
Feel real good with your hands in the air and lick two shots in the atmosphere.
It's been 3 weeks since you were looking for your friend, the one you let hit it and never called you again. Remember when he told you he was about to Benjamins? You act like you ain't him, they give him a little trim to be.
Joining us now is Rafia Zakaria. She's a columnist for the Dawn newspaper in Pakistan. Rafia, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I have no idea. It was so weird what that gap was, but it's fine. We're here now. We're cool, calm, and collected and ready to go.
All right.
It's always great to be talking with you. So let's start by what happened in Pakistan over the weekend. There was a really horrific attack in Lahore, in the Punjab, that targeted Christians over celebrating Easter at a public park in Lahore. We'll obviously get into more detail in the context for it, but can you just kind of explain the attack first, where it took place, the significance of it, and who's claimed responsibility for it?
Yes, you know, as we all know now, there was a big attack in Lahore. Over 70 people are said to have been killed. There's hundreds and hundreds who are injured. A lot of them are women and children. In the media narrative, though, there are two, I think that are pretty glaring sort of, they're not exactly misstatements, but I think they're kind of creating, you know, some misperceptions about what happened. The first is that while the Taliban has said that they were targeting Christians, and it was Easter Sunday, the vast majority of victims are Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Sunday is the only public holiday in Pakistan. These parks, this was kind of a an area of mostly working class people in Lahore, where a lot of working class families will take their kids in the evening. There's a carousel there. So it's important to remember that, to remember the fact that, you know, while it did happen on Easter Sunday and while some families, some Christian families were there, the vast majority, Pakistan is 98% or 99% actually Muslim. So, you know, the vast majority of people that died are Muslims. The other thing I think is that's important to note is what has been happening in Pakistan between the government and their standoff before various sort of extremist groups. And that is that Sunday was also the day that many of the fringe extremist groups in Pakistan were commemorating 40 days since the execution of a man who had been convicted for assassinating the governor of Punjab, which is mm-hmm. where this attack took place. So, you know, if you'd been watching Pakistani TV, for instance, before you cut to the horrific attack, there was live coverage of all the major cities in Pakistan seeing these huge, angry mobs who are so angry at the government for having carried out that execution of that assassin who they claim to be a hero, you know. And so that was taking place as well. Mm-hmm. And this attack is part of sort of that, ongoing confrontation between the Pakistani government and these hardline groups. The fact is that in recent weeks, the government has done things that have really angered the Islamists. The first among those is directly related to Pakistan's minorities. The government has declared, Hindu and Christian holidays as national public holidays in Pakistan. And that is something that has irked these very hardline Islamist groups who don't want that. And so that is one backdrop. And the other backdrop is that the government, this government, has taken a stand against a lot of these hardline groups. And the execution of Mumtaz Qadri was part of showing that stance. So, you know, this was in many ways retaliation against that. It was a soft target. I mean, you know, we now know everywhere in the world how difficult it is to secure every place. Mm-hmm. And this place was not where there was like a 4-foot tall boundary wall to the park that could, you know, anyone could scale it. Now just as you see the discussions in Brussels and Paris before that, the discussion in Pakistan is, why was this place not secure? Should we not have metal detectors and other security apparatus, in these children's parks, which is in itself, you know, such a kind of grim consideration.
Absolutely. So, and so just to pivot off of what you said, the group that took responsibility for this, which is as far as I understand it, Jamaat-ul-Ahrar faction of the Pakistani Taliban, they said specifically when they took credit for it, that partially it was to attack Christians celebrating Easter, which would link with what you're saying in terms of this sort of broader backlash towards moves towards a little bit more inclusivity that the prime minister is moving towards. But then they also said that, you know, and Nawaz Sharif, the prime minister, his political base and his background and his brother, I believe, is also the governor of the Punjab, mm-hmm. that we're taking this specifically to your home region and showing you that your base and your support and your sort of geography is not safe. Those seem to be the sort of two kind of prime points that they made in claiming these attacks. And I'm curious about that from the perspective of understanding Nawaz Sharif. I mean, he has a long history in Pakistani politics going back to the 1980s. He was deposed in a coup by Pervez Musharraf over a decade ago. He was in exile in Saudi Arabia and he came back. a couple years ago and sort of wound up again as prime minister, he had a reputation in some of his earlier iterations as being pretty accommodating in a certain sense of the sort of radical religious right in Pakistan. Is that something that is changing in terms of his sort of ideological tone, or is it that it's different when you're kind of playing with exporting this kind of politics versus it being sort of turned inward in your own backyard?
Actually, that's a really good point. It has been somewhat of a surprise to, I think, a lot of people just how vocal this prime minister has been, as well as the issues that he has been, him and his administration have been interested in taking up. And you could, you could sort of pin it to a number of different factors. I do think that the December 2015 attack on Army Public School in Peshawar, in which over 200 Pakistani children were killed, was a turning point in terms of Pakistan's fight against terror. I think following that, there has been more of a concerted effort, both by the civilian government, and then, of course, there has been the military operation that has been taking place to really get a handle on this, to sort of enforce the writ of the state back on the territory of the country. That attack, because, like this one, there were so many children that were so brutally murdered in it that it really was something that kind of woke a lot of people up in Pakistan and impressed. And since then, there have been a number of measures that, they're not perfect, but they have changed sort of the war on terror landscape. I mean, one thing that this government has done or is doing, for instance, is trying to register all the religious schools or the madrasas in the country, which is very, very difficult. They've sealed, I think, 182 of them, which they've identified as madrasas that, were harboring or promoting extremist ideology. So they've kind of taken that on. The other thing, like I said, the minority rights issue is one that they've been interested in taking up. And then most controversially, I think, is that they said that they are willing to review the blasphemy law in Pakistan, right, which is, at the core of a lot of intimidation by these Islamist groups. I mean, even while this attack was happening in Lahore, in Islamabad, there was a video of a man who's been accused of blasphemy. He's actually a religious sort of television religious figure himself, was mobbed at the airport in Islamabad because he's purportedly accused of blasphemy, accused, and people wanted to beat him up and put an end to him. So the fact that the government has even said that they're willing to review these things is very new, and they're very. It is true that in 2015. There has been, I think, a 56% drop in terrorist attacks in Pakistan. So some of their measures have worked. Of course, it's difficult kind of to say that today in the aftermath of Lahore and just how grisly that's been. But the government seems to be taking this very seriously. As we see, it's not an easy war. The challenge, of course, is that, as we've talked about before, is that most people want to condemn all of Pakistan and all of Pakistanis as terrorists, especially in the larger global context. And that's what becomes a problem, is because, here now you've got hundreds of families that are so horribly wounded. They keep showing there's one family that actually lost 8 of their family members. In the attack, they had all come to vacation in Lahore, and they had all gone to this park, Muslim family, And eight of them died right just, you know, all together. So they've got eight funerals to arrange. And so when you see things like that happening and you see that the grief of these people is not considered equal to the grief of Brussels or Paris, then you see sort of the moral double standard that exists, you know, globally in the war against terror. And that's, you know, that's precisely what these extremist groups are hoping for. They're hoping that there's just going to be, you know, the fact that this blanket condemnation of all Pakistanis, and there won't be really any bonds of solidarity between victims that are in different parts of the world.
Right, and I think that it's interesting because you have a couple of different tracks on this. I mean, we've talked recently on this program about the rise in attacks by Al-Qaeda and or even in some cases potentially ISIS sort of inspired or even affiliated groups in West Africa that have targeted civilians in Mali, in Cote d'Ivoire. And obviously all of the civilians sort of being slaughtered across Iraq and Syria and, of course, in Pakistan. And what's interesting is that in West Africa, it's sort of the sin of omission. And then in Pakistan, it's kind of there is a subtext of, you know, not exactly you guys deserve this, but there's a context in which you've sort of brought it on yourselves. And I think that, you know, this is what we need to figure out, right? And actually, in some ways, we can kind of pivot to the decolonizing education piece from this. But it seems to me that there are three sort of tracks to work out right now. You have the state relationship between the United States and Pakistan is incredibly dysfunctional on both sides. So the United States has backed every type of, you know, coup, corrupt civilian government, has sort of wanted to basically just use Pakistan in some ways as just sort of like a funnel for money and drone attacks. Then the Pakistani governments have played a sort of double game with groups like the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. And then, of course, lost in the middle of this and in the media discourse is a second track, which is civil society sort of uprising and working to kind of overcome these patterns, not only in terrorism, but also in inequality and also in lack of pluralism, which sets the conditions. And then we have a third track where it does seem like some of these groups are metastasizing and kind of taking on an even sort of greater edge of horror and violence in current iterations. Because, you know, when Sharif first came to office, he definitely was saying, well, you know, we're going to have some negotiations with factions of the Taliban. We're going to have more of a diplomatic track on this. And obviously attacks like this are so far outside of the realm of what can sort of be there. You can't have a sort of, there's nothing to reconcile there. So you have these three discrete tracks, and then the media narrative does not in any way take on the sort of complexity of the first one. It ignores the second one, and then it explains the third, but without any context.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think the key point that you made, you know, they sort of deserve this as the attitude toward Pakistani victims of terror is at the core of this. I mean, the fact is that there's a lot of blame to go around. There's a lot of complicity to go around. But if you're an ordinary Pakistani person who's just kind of gone, I mean, or a child in this case, I mean, the fact is you have absolutely no power to try to control or, you know, stop this. I mean, I don't think people realize that. I mean, I think there's, you know, this constant refrain that, oh, Muslims need to realize that this is a problem. Well, gosh, Muslims have realized. I mean, every form of daily life in Pakistan has been stunted and disrupted by terror. I think that the challenge, of course, is that they are at the front lines. They're dealing with hundreds of attacks every year, mm-hmm. while the Western world deals with maybe, what, four or five? Mm-hmm. And the inordinate difference in attention is crucial here, because if you want to be united against the war on terror, you have to start to value the victims equally. You cannot say that just because they're Muslim, they don't count as victims because they're somehow complicit. I think the other issue that's really getting left out of the discussion on this, you know, in the radical Islam is the refrain again and again, is that this is far more radical than it is Islamic. You know, I mean, it's more of an anarchist and sort of rebellious movement. It's interesting. CNN, I think, is running a story today on how the Brussels bombers party, you know, went out partying before before they did these attacks and things like that. Because, again, you know, there's this sort of just compulsive and obsessive need to say that these people are Islamic and that this is somehow Muslim. And, you know, there's something about this religion that promotes this. And it's basically not true. I mean, the fact is, these are parasitic groups that, you know, that essentially hone in on weakness, whether it's a weakness in a tribe or a city or a ghettoized neighborhood in Brussels or Paris, and they grow like parasites within that environment, within that ecosystem.
And what weakens the immune system, right, to allow that?
Precisely. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, Islam at best is a very incidental host, you know, that they have sort of, I mean, because it's also true that if you're Muslim today, if you're born Muslim today, you're more likely to be a refugee, you're more likely to be living in a war-torn land, you're more likely to have very limited prospects. So unless we understand that, we're not going to understand, I mean, unless this compulsion goes away. So, because essentially what we're saying is that these people are bad over and over again. Well, everyone agrees that they're bad. We're not trying to understand exactly how that interacts with us. We're also not trying to understand the moral argument that they make. I mean, you have to understand that while Westerners are watching videos of this and saying, how can this be? People in the Muslim world are also watching videos of Saudi bombings of Yemen that are killing lots of children. They've watched lots of videos of Afghans bombed and by the United States that have killed lots of children, and on and on and on. So the moral balance and the moral sort of question is very disrupted. And then going to the issue of decolonizing education, you know, the base of that and the base of our discussion here that we're talking about is that I don't think people understand or are even interested in understanding that the war on terror will never be won by killing the number one or the number two or capturing Osama bin Laden or assassinating Baghdadi or doing any of those things. Because ultimately, there has to be a philosophical and ideological response to the kind of critique that these groups are making. And that critique is an anti-imperialist critique. It's a critique of the forms of knowledge. In the article that I sent you, that's out. That
this
talks
is in
about
the Dawn. We have it linked to on our website.
Dawn article. Mm-hmm. Yep, about decolonizing education. You know, I talk about, I think in that article, about the letter that one of the Taliban commanders wrote to Malala Yousafzai, the young girl that was shot by the Taliban and survived the Nobel Peace Prize winner. And in it, they say that, look, we're not opposed to education. And he actually quotes this British colonialist who said that our goal is to produce people who are Indian in skin and British in their mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I quote that is that that is at the center of so much of the sort of ideological warfare that these extremist groups are perpetuating. This idea that it's inauthentic to participate in an educational system whose forms of knowledge originated in colonialism. And I cannot emphasize to you how crucial and important that is, and how ignored it is in our rhetoric on the war on terror.
So this brings up a number of important questions, because first, I think it is really important, again, to notate the irony of a group like ISIS or the Pakistani Taliban having a rhetoric on imperialism and colonialism when in their own sort of zones, they're incredibly imperialistic in their own sort of environments and sort of, you know, obviously totalitarian and sort of, you know, attempting to eliminate difference, you know, including obviously through mass killing and barbarism in their context. So there is an irony to that. And then the other thing that I think that this raises, and I know that this, for whatever reason, this makes this conversation is very, very uncomfortable for a lot of people. And it's a problem that it's so uncomfortable, because, again, I feel like we have another sort of three tracks here where, you know, there's this narrative that gets reiterated again and again and again, whether it's from sort of, trendy kind of atheist writers or, you know, certain foreign policy thinking, which is that essentially, look, the rest of the world needs to catch up with certain value systems. And that's, it's contradicted by the fact that if your foreign policy doesn't allow the rest of the world to, quote unquote, catch up, then that's a performative contradiction. And then on the second hand, I think that there are some, you know, there's a strain where we can get into almost this sort of extreme relativism, where we're not making distinctions and we're not making the kind of arguments for human rights and openness that you make. But then you come on a third track that people have a very difficult time with, which is the notion that the battle is like inside the context. What is a left-wing Islam? What is a left-wing, you know, Buddhism, whatever. The point is that people looking inside to their own sources and their own traditions to establish their own rights and norms. And part of the reason I think that you've argued, and correct me if I'm wrong, that fanaticism has flourished in some ways is that the terrain of thinking in a non-colonial way has been ceded to these fanatical groups. So it's almost like a pre-critique instead of a post-critique. And then you have this zone where a Taliban commander could make actually a very interesting point about educational methodology and history of education in South Asia and colonialism. And then at the same time, in the context of, you know, ordering a hit on a child.
Yep. I mean, you're exactly right. I would hone in on two of the points that you made that I think are crucial. One is, you know, you talked about the barbarism. And I think what people don't understand that the barbarism as a political aesthetic is not incidental.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very intentional. Because in a visible opposition to everything that is modern and everything that is sort of represents kind of society or civilization, it is showing or trying to sell itself as consequently more authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And so its moral dimensions are not necessarily in the acts themselves. They are in their opposition.
Mm-hmm.
So that you've got an Islam that is no longer defined by Islamic doctrine, but in its opposition to sort of modern systems of justice or what have you. And so, so that's one aspect of it. The other point that you talked about was is this sort of ceding of territory or sort of the ceding of the argument of anti-imperialist position to these extremist fringe groups. And you're absolutely right. That is one of the biggest defeats, I think, of the war on terror. This is why we are losing, is because we have permitted that. And the problem is that if you are someone who opposes that, you know, say, I'll give you the example of friends of mine who are activists in Pakistan, who are sort of on the front line, standing up against these crazy extremist mobs. And then, you know, they applied to try to get a visa to attend a conference in New York or London. And they're denied because they're considered a security risk. So you tell me how you would feel then. Because, look, right now, the way we have it, there are two global discourses. You know, there's a transnational global discourse of sort of interconnectedness and human rights and shared values and sort of this sort of cyber realm in which everyone participates to some extent and that is very vibrant and lively. But there's a dark other side to globalism too. And then you've got people in countries like Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, Yemen, Libya, who are isolated from the rest of the world. They can't leave because essentially if you have a passport from one of those countries, you cannot, you can't leave. Basically, that's the reality. And so then what do you do? Who do you cast your lot with? Should you cast it with the people who are very, you know, in a very bloody and grotesque way, disavowing any kind of solidarity internationally? Do you join up with the kind of ISIS? I mean, one of the first things ISIS does when they get a recruit is burn their passport. And I don't think that people understand the significance of that for vast young populations who see themselves as imprisoned by their passports. There's millions of them. I mean, just in Pakistan, 60% of the population is under 20. And so I don't think that there is a realization of how that rhetoric works. I think the Western world is largely sort of, immersed in either just disdain or dismissiveness. And they're sort of framing the question as self-protection, rather than actually winning the war on terror. Winning the war on terror, like you said, requires some very difficult conversations. It requires sort of confronting that there is moral shame on either side. I mean, just today, right, there's The Guardian has released a story of how the CIA took naked pictures of people who were tortured. And that those pictures are there. Now, you know, that's sort of somewhere in the periphery of the American news cycle, but that's going to be at the center of, news cycles in parts of the Muslim world. And you could attach the same sort of comment that you attach to an ISIS beheading to that fact. I mean, here were people who are being tortured and their pictures are being taken. But there isn't, I mean, you know, that juxtaposition just never takes place. There is this constant just refrain, we are good, they're bad. And until we remain stuck on that, I don't think we can really ever fight this war or win this war. I mean, you know, we fought it against the Taliban, we fought it against Al-Qaeda, now we're fighting it against ISIS. But nobody seems to consider that these are all flavors of the month. The core problem is the same, and we're not really engaging with the core problem. We're not engaging with the idea that we need to take back decolonization from these Islamist fringe groups. Decolonization, whether it's of education or journalism or whatever, has to be a project that the liberals and the left have to embrace and take on. Otherwise, there's really just no competing discourse to the sort of ideology that we see with ISIS and these groups.
And this has nothing to do, as we move into sort of wrapping this up, I just want to kind of run a couple things by you. I think it's very important to emphasize that this has nothing to do with some sort of lazy kind of moral relativism, which people who engage in the type of discourse we're engaging in get accused of. What this is about is the rigor to make all of these distinctions simultaneously and hold these different tracks at the same time, even the different track of, you know, dealing with an immediate security challenge in Pakistan, the difficulty of how do you sort of counter recruiting techniques in Europe that are almost more analogous in some ways to the way like Scientology recruits people. I mean, it's a whole other set of questions. And then this deeper kind of global comparison of rights and norms, colonialism, anti-colonialism, and how that manifests. I mean, the two sort of things that I want to get your response to before we leave is it you know, one concrete example of this is someone who's influenced me a lot is, you know, Amartya Sen, who has written about and talked about this notion of global human rights and the sort of interest in accountability and democracy are not Western inventions. Obviously, specific variations of them are Western inventions, but this desire for accountability, for norms, for openness, you can find roots of in any tradition globally. And more people are going to be interested in justifying those norms through their roots. And I think, and then the other notion was, you know, going back to the 1990s, we had this idea of like the jihad versus the Mick world, that the kind of totalizing globalism of the West, which brought a lot of damaging consequences from everything from labor to kind of cultural hegemony. And then the response of jihad, and in that book, it wasn't just like jihad, it was also Serbian nationalism. It was also many other kind of manifestations of terrorism or neo-fascism in response to this sort of totalizing globalization. And that the answer was, again, rooted somehow in these local democracies that could be self-generative but also cross boundaries in a stronger and more authentic way, if we could use that word again.
I think that this, you know, I think that there was hope for this idea of, you know, of human rights not being rooted in Western civilization, perhaps before Afghanistan. Mm. I think one of the casualties of the human rights gloss that was put on the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan has been that that premise has been largely delegitimized, where human rights now are seen, and I'm not saying that as a value judgment, I'm actually just saying that as a descriptive comment. Right. Human rights are essentially now seen as an offshoot of American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, whatever, wherever America decides to intervene is suddenly a human rights issue. Mm-hmm. And in that way justifies that presence. And I think that that has taken an incredible toll on the people who want to sort of extricate human rights from a, you know, a singularly American perspective. And kind of, you know, focus it on something more global. The other issue is just, you know, the double standard. I mean, look, I can go on and on and on about human rights and believe in it, but the fact is that right now, vast populations of the human rights championing West are refusing entry to people who are fleeing war. Mm-hmm. And all of that is based on the accident of birth. Mm-hmm. I mean, someone who is born on one side of the border suddenly deserves more rights than someone who's born on a different side. So, you know, so there are these sort of holes within the human rights framework that require deep thought, that require debate, that we've just kind of abandoned. I mean, there's a sort of blanket assumption that our failures are justified. So, you know, when the United States or, you know, Germany or France or Sweden say, you know, we're not going to admit any more refugees because you know, this is Sweden is for Swedes, therefore it's for us. It's for people who have the luck of being born within this country. What does that really say in terms of universal human dignity? It basically says that it works when it works for me. Mm-hmm. And so there are these two enormous holes in human rights discourse right now that are making it very difficult to sort of resurrect, or, I mean, you know, both of the examples that you gave are really interesting ones, because I think that they're both pre-Afghanistan examples.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan, there's a huge fear of even sort of participating in the human rights discourse, because there is this fear that if that somehow aligns with what the U.S. wants to do strategically, it's going to lead to your country being bombed, you know, and occupied. And so...
And that was the argument of people who do abuse human rights, like Robert Mugabe. I mean, that's like the
precisely.
Whole... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's interesting, because what it does is it shows just the bankruptcy of our current ideological state. It just shows how little we have in terms of sort of philosophical engagement with human rights issues. I mean, another huge issue is Saudi Arabia. I mean,
sure.
Currently Saudi Arabia is involved in the most egregious human rights abuses, and we're giving them the bombs and the weapons to
mm-hmm.
do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, to bring people on the table for human rights, there has to be a confrontation of just how dark the situation is right now. And I don't think that there is a willingness to do that. I think that there are a lot of sort of platitudes, especially on the left, that are spoken, that are very insistent on refusing to sort of, I mean, look, just on this issue of these bombings, I mean, every time I say on Twitter that a bombing in Lahore or Istanbul or Ankara doesn't get the attention that a bombing in Brussels or Paris does, there are so many people, many of whom are part of, you know, the wire services and the journalistic establishment, who just lash out in the most rude and insulting way. Because they don't think that there is a problem there. They don't mm-hmm. think that there's that this issue, that we don't have a live stream from Lahore, that people aren't learning the names of the neighborhoods of Lahore, you know, Molenbeek, Schaarbeek, whatever, like they did in Brussels. They don't see that as a problem. You know, there is some sort of like inherent sort of defensiveness about the fact that we are entitled to grieve more for one than another. And until you address that, we're not going to get anywhere at all.
So winning the war on terrorism requires courage, and global values means global values. Rafia Zakaria, it's always a great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be on.
All right. Talk to you soon. All right, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half, where you can join us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. You can go to jet.com through Majority Report Kickback and get 15% off of your first purchase. You can also go to Majority Report Kickback and use our Amazon link and give us a couple of pennies from your Amazon purchase. You can go to justcoffee.coop, fair trade, tea, coffee, chocolate, all of those good things. Write us a review on iTunes. It makes a big difference. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Even if you're a member, it makes a big difference. Of course, subscribe to Two Dope Boys and a Podcast on iTunes. What else should we tell people? We will go to the fun half. 646-257-3920.